I have never seen another movie like The People's Joker. It's like a dream you might have after watching the Joel Schumacher Batman movies if your subconscious is trying to use Batman to tell you something very important about yourself. The film stars our guest today, writer-director Vera Drew, who plays a trans comedian who takes on the new identity of Joker the Harlequin, a person who has elements of both the Joker and Harley Quinn, to try to save Gotham from the comic tyranny of Lorne Michaels, who is kind of like the real-life Lorne Michaels who leads Saturday Night Live, but kind of different, and the UCB, which is kind of like the real-life Upright Citizens Brigade Theater and Improv School, but kind of different. You could see this movie as a test of whether those comedy institutions have a sense of humor about themselves. Drew's Joker is also haunted by the specter of Batman. When she was growing up, instead of being attracted to his femme fatale adversaries, she was attracted to him. But she learns in the film that he has a secret identity. And I ain't talking about Bruce Wayne. It's a parody, which is important to note for legal reasons we'll get into, but it goes deeper into Batman mythology than any Batman or Joker movie I've ever seen, finding room for wonderfully demented versions of even very minor characters. It also features a cameo, capital C and lowercase c, by Robert Wool, who played reporter Alexander Knox in Tim Burton's 1989 Batman, a movie I saw in a theater for my 14th birthday. It's a very important movie in my life. As a huge Bat fan, I was a little skeptical of The People's Joker when I heard that it ran into some drama at the Toronto International Film Festival last fall. Warner Brothers unsurprisingly took issue with Drew's use of their very profitable characters. My initial reaction was that, of course, you can't just make your own Joker movie. But having now seen the film and read up quite a bit on protection for parodies, I have a much better understanding of what's legally allowed and what isn't. I now feel that it is its own living piece of art, to borrow a phrase from the Jack Nicholson Joker. A lot of comedy and Batman nerdery is going to come up in this episode, and I could try to set it all up, but honestly, I think that, like The People's Joker, this is something you're either going to get or not. I'm Tim Malloy, welcome to Movie Maker, and I hope you enjoyed this talk with Vera Drew, writer, director, editor, and star of the awesome new film, The People's Joker. Thank you so much for doing this. Welcome to Movie Maker. Congratulations on The People's Joker. I really super enjoyed this movie, and I think I'm pretty much in like the exact right demographic for it in most ways.
Okay.
I'm trans. But I have been through UCB training to level 3. and I'm also a huge Batman nerd. And you reminded me of so much Batman stuff that I didn't even know I'd forgotten. Like it's just like encyclopedic. It's really incredible. So I feel like I kind of know you from watching the movie, but I don't know how much overlap there is with your character. Can you just say who you are, where you're from, how you got into comedy and film?
The movie is like ridiculously autobiographical. It's actually really funny because like I've done so many interviews now where like it always gets printed like the semi-autobiographical Joker movie or whatever. And I'm like, no, like I can't watch it like because it's kind of traumatic for me to watch. It is like pretty much just my life, but the only difference is like I'm not, you know, the actual Joker. I started doing comedy actually way younger than Joker the Harlequin starts it. I started when I was 13. I was a part of this like pilot improv program that like Second City Chicago was doing for youth. Like the early 2000s, and comedy was this like saving grace for me. Like for the first 10 years of doing it, like I was like, you know, an annoying little comedy nerd, like really obsessed with SNL, really obsessed with Mr. Show.
Great.
And I loved improv so much, but it was so pure for me. It was just like this outlet of creativity and expression. And I'd always wanted to make film, and I, you know, like my earliest memories were wanting to be a filmmaker, but comedy was just like where I could get my creativity out. And I went to film school, was still doing like stand up and sketch and improv throughout that period, and I was a straight, quote unquote, straight man at that point. But never, anytime I did stand up, I was always in drag. I would only ever do it in drag, and I think it was almost like on this subconscious level, it was just like that was where I felt safe doing it.
Yeah.
And when I graduated college, like I moved to LA, kind of hoping originally to continue my like performance, co my comedy performance career or whatever. But, you know, UCB kind of was the only game in town here as far as like getting real stage time and getting seen. Like when I moved out here in 2012, like there weren't really like any alt spaces. Like the alt comedy boom was like kind of just about was starting, but like as far as like live alt comedy, like there was nothing. It was just UCB, and I made it up to level three as well. So it's funny that it's only as far as you made it, because I made it to level three, and you know, and at that point I've been doing improv like for over 10 years and was pretty good at it, but like I just did not fit in that template at all. Like A, because I was a fucking poor person and like it's so expensive to take their classes. I mean, I don't know if it still is. Like I know they got a whole new thing now, or whatever, but like for it was just like it felt like Scientology. So that's kind of why we made it like a esoteric cult in the movie. It's like it just it's not a coincidence that UCB LA is right across the street from the Celebrity Scientology Center. Thankfully, I had this teacher in level three who was just like, "You're so funny. You're maybe one of the best improvisers I've ever seen. You're clearly unhappy here. You're clearly not a UCB improviser. Like, you don't follow game. You aren't like, you like know yes and, but you're finding the wiggle room around it." And like, I was just very deconstructionist too. Like, I'm. You know, I've always been kind of a video art person, so like I think in the way that I've always approached comedy has always been from this like, let's like, yes, know the rules, but let's like, fucking rip them apart while we're also following them. But thankfully, yeah, I got out of there and kind of was just like, I'm gonna carve my own path, and thankfully, I was where I. Started working with Tim and Eric and became an editor at Tim and Eric and worked on a lot of really cool stuff there. It was really like perfect timing just because it was like my first job was season one of Eric Andre's show, and then my next job was season one of Nathan For You. And like I was just kind of surrounded by these like comedic geniuses at a point in my career where like I wasn't fit for the industry. I was not ready to be out there in the workforce. Like I was a little fucking drug addict, closeted freak full of like I was just like I really thought like Hollywood was waiting for me too, but Hollywood is never waiting for anybody. It is like it'll ask you for a lot of things, but it's yeah, like so thankfully I like really just kind of fell into it with like the Tim and Eric crowd and you know, and was able to sort of like meet a lot of people through there where I could go off and like do my own things and like make video art and explore performance through like video and like filming stuff. And you know, I started a public access station with some friends.
Great.
Like it's and that's really where I think, you know, in the People's Joker, Joker the Harlequin, our character our Joker starts an illegal comedy theater with her best friend Penguin. And that's really where that came from was just like being in LA, being like, I don't know how to get stage time because I'm too weird and too gay for stage time. So let's like shove my face into, you know, the internet by just getting like a group of like-minded people together so we can just like make stuff. And that's really what we did, and it really like I think that's the only reason I kind of survived in that period before, you know, living out here and before making the movie. Just like I had an outlet that I had kind of carved out for myself.
The movie does make some like really sharp-edged observations. Oh my God, that sounded so cliché, sharp-edged observations about like diversity in comedy. And at one point, spoiler alert, UCB starts sort of a diversity cast, which everybody looks on with a bit of mockery, because I think David Spade has three of the five spots for some reason.
Yeah.
But it was as much as like diversity is like a buzzword now and became like sort of a thing that everybody was acting like they've always been on board with from the beginning about 5 years ago, it really was not the case in around 2012, 2013,
No.
2014 at all.
But you know what? I and this isn't something that I really remembered until recently, but I was on a diversity cast when I was a kid. Like when I was like 15, I was, and I was not, I was very, very closeted at this point. Like just a sweaty little theater kid that wanted to do improv. But I got into this like diversity team at IO that they were doing for like teenagers. And I remember getting on and I was like, what is this? Like I'm white. I am an upper middle class like kid from the suburbs. Like I'm about as not diverse as it gets, especially like for, Southland Chicago. But I finally figured it out because after my first show, my teacher came up to me afterwards, and my teacher was Sharna Halpern, who
Oh,
like
cool.
effectively invented improv with Del Close and started IO and stuff. And she and I say this with love, because it was she it came from a really great place. But she grabbed me and she said, "You're so talented. Like you have such a bright future ahead of you. You're just like a young Andy Dick," is what she said to me, which is like was such a terrifying thing for me to hear, because I was like, what does she mean? Like Andy Dick, like at that point, like I kind of Andy Dick, noted creep for the entirety of Andy Dick's legacy as Andy Dick, but also just like it was this realization where it's like she thinks I'm gay, like she thinks I'm gay, like that's why I'm here. I'm the gay and the diversity here. And like I think like that was just so deeply in my subconscious. And like and like when I came out as trans, like it I had been working in TV for a very long time at that point, and it did affect my career, which is like always kind of feels weird to talk about because like I don't want to sound like I'm complaining. Like I had a really awesome career, but like I did, I was in the process of starting to like get directing gigs and stuff, and then when I came out, a lot of those gigs just started to go away and those opportunities started to go away. But then
Wait,
I
what year was
noticed
that
like
roughly, or years?
that would have been like 20 end of 2017, beginning of 2018.
Wow.
And like what was weird about that was like I noticed that in the beginning of my transition, but then when I was like deeper into my transition and I had boobs and I was like I knew how to do my makeup a little bit better. I'd have this different kind of thing that would happen where I'd get asked to be in writers' rooms and stuff, and it would become clear, like, oh, I got hired for this job just because I'm trans. Like, I'm here kind of as like a diversity chip for this like showrunner. And like notably on one, I won't say what the show was just because like I don't think it's gonna ever come out because it fell apart while we were writing it because like it was a disaster. But like I was working on this reboot of a show in the writer's room, and like again, can't say what the show was, but like huge influence on me, a cartoon from the 90s that I grew up watching, and I was super excited to work on it. But I reached, I was it had this other like existential moment similar to that like Andy Dick moment where I was like looking around the writer's room and realizing like it's me and it's like all these cis women. Oh, we all got hired just to rehabilitate this
Oh,
problematic cartoon.
I
And
know what
like
the
it's it
problematic
was
cartoon is. Okay, all right.
Some people could figure it out. I can't say, and
Course.
but it was like it was crazy because it was just like obviously, like, I prefer allyship to, outright transphobia, I guess. But it was this like realization that was like, oh, like the diversity thing has now grown to this, where it's like like I'm like a little token that they can add to their project to give it a little bit more like wokeness or legitimacy, which is just so funny to me because it's like I and the movie I made are about as woke as an F slur. I mean, like, it's just not, like, I respect people. I get people's pronouns right. I'm not racist or a bigot, but like the idea of like
It's
trans
really
people or
funny.
queer
I
people being
mean,
more, yeah,
I
it's
don't mean
pretty
to like
funny.
interject, but like the movie's going
No,
for
go for it.
laughs. Like it's not going for like we're good people here. Like everyone appreciate like how decent and upstanding we are. It's really, really funny. And there's just great asides and great little moments and things like that all over the place. And I read an interview where you said that you had a form of autism where you couldn't detect sarcasm. Is that true? Because it seems like your sarcasm meter is like perfectly attuned.
I thank you. I can't tell when other people are being sarcastic. Like I know when I got it. But like it's kind of a curse because like I do feel like my sensibility is like I really do like to oscillate between like hardcore sincerity and shit posting, I guess. And like for me, like the movie was kind of trying to bridge those two things together. Like I think a note that I always used to get during my career was like, I don't know what you're doing with this scene. Like it's you put this music under it that is like, is it supposed to be funny? Is it supposed to be sincere? Is it ironic? And my answer would always be like, yes, I don't know. It just works, right? And like so for me, it's like, I think I don't know that it's like my superpower. I think I don't know. I don't really know how to be funny on purpose, I think is really my thing in a lot of ways.
Well, that mix is why I like the People's Joker. There's like this mix of it could play in a museum, it could play in a bar, it could play at midnight in a film festival. It really just works in a lot of different ways. I don't think it could play at 8 o'clock on CBS. But like it could play in so many different environments and be read so many different ways. It's just like this is like a cool punk rock, like fun movie. Or is like, oh, there's really a lot of depth going on here. And like the levels of criticism and social commentary and the layers of metaphor with Batman, with comedy, with everything else, is just you could watch it many, many, many times, and get something out every time. But I want to just get into
Thank
how
you.
you made it. I understand. There was sort of a online fight about Todd Phillips' Joker, and someone Venmo'd you $12, and that was the start of the budget.
Pretty much, yeah. It all started with my first artistic commission ever, and it was $12, and it was the beginning of the pandemic, so I was not getting hired to add fart sound effects to television shows anymore. Yeah, my friend Brie LaRose, who's a writer, or who she was a writer on Lady Dynamite and Arrested Development and stuff, and she was the one that commissioned it, and it came from just yeah, like Todd Phillips was in the news, like talking about woke culture and how like it was too hard to make comedy now, which is just so such a boring thing for like the director of like a
Right.
movie that made $1 billion to say, that is also a comedy. Like Joker 2019 is obviously like a dark comedy, but it's a comedy. Like it's honestly it's a parody of King of Comedy. Like it's a comedic parody of Taxi Driver.
Totally.
Yeah, I started re-editing it in earnest just because like I wanted something to work on and kind of just started making it as this sort of like video art thing. And it was going to be just kind of a video art project, sort of looking at my own queerness and like through the lens of these characters, and in kind of this abstract way. But that abstractness really kind of like as I was working on it, I just felt this pull towards narrative, and like I was like, I want to actually make this. I think I want to actually make a movie here. And like I'd wanted to make a movie my whole life and hadn't at that point. So it was like, now's maybe the time, because like I don't know when the world is going to start back up again. So I went back to Brie LaRose, and I was like, will you help me write this Joker parody that is kind of just about my life? And you know, I want you to help me not only like write this sort of like autobiographical coming of age story, but like whatever you want to bring to it too, from like your experience, because Brie's also queer and you know has been working in comedy as about as long as I have. We came out around the same time too. Like it was really this kind of like creative match made in heaven. And yeah, and then from there we wrote a script, and you know, as far as not micro as far as micro budget film scripts go, like this was like the most ambitious script ever written. Like we did not know how we were going to pull off anything we were writing. And I think while we were doing it, I was kind of like, well, maybe it'll still kind of be like a video remix or something. And maybe like, I don't know, like I didn't really have a plan. It was just like, let's just write the best script we can, and let's write it like it is a comic book movie. And I'm Brie doesn't watch comic book movies. Like she watches like The Whale Rider and like, you know, fucking Little Women. I love Little Women, but like she's like more of the like
But you've gone
quiet
deep on like Joel Schumacher Batman. You've gone deep on Danny Elfman Batman. I'm sorry, not Danny Elfman,
totally.
Tim Burton Batman. There's so many cool allusions to the 1989 Batman. You have not only Robert Wool in the movie, but you also have Bob Odenkirk playing the Joker's assistant for like 5 seconds.
Yes.
And then there's also some like very, very cool stuff with Frank Miller's version of Robin from Dark Knight. But what does all this cost? I mean, can I just ask what the cost of this movie is?
Yeah, I mean, like, it's tough to say, because like the process was so organic that like I never had like a budget. Like I never really had like, here's a roadmap. Like I would never make a movie like this again. And I don't even advise anybody make a movie the way I made it, 'cause like I think it was just a right place, right time. Like, you know, like in 2020 it was like, okay, I can't work, so I'll get a PPP loan so that I can like stay self-employed and maybe pick up some freelance gigs, and while I'm doing that, like I'll work on this movie and like I'll kind of just pay myself. But then like, you know, that ran out, and like I kind of reached a point where I was like, okay, now we need to film it. And I wanted it to look good, 'cause I knew like every shot was going to be on blue screen. So like it needed to look good. It needed to be lit well. I needed to shoot it in a soundstage. Like I couldn't just shoot it in my house. Like I had to do that. So I crowdfunded it,
Oh yeah,
that
well, how much
shoot,
did you
and
crowd for? That's a good way to ask it.
yeah, we raised I think just shy of like 25K, and
Wow.
all of that. I know, and like it was crazy, because like I think my goal was 10, but I'm glad I raised that amount, because all of that went into our shoot. Like literally pretty much every single dime of that went into the shoot. Which was cool, 'cause it looks great and it was lit well and we got everything we needed. But then, you know, I finished the movie in 5 days. Like literally we shot it in 5 days.
If
And
you told
then
me 250,000, I would have believed you. Like it looks that good. If you told me 2.5 million, I'd believe you. Like,
well, thank you. I mean, we definitely ended up spending a lot more, you know, because like after we wrapped, I had surgery after we wrapped, and then like so kind of had a downtime. And then when I came out of surgery, I like opened up my computer and was like, it finally settled in for me, like, oh, like I actually have to like put this together now. Like I gotta edit it. And I had this whole team of like artists that wanted to work with me on it. A lot of them had already started working with me on it too, like and coming up with previs and sets and stuff. And I was just like, I need a lot more money to finish this. Like I've used up my crowdfund. I had a Patreon that was bringing in about 400 a month that I was like able to put a little bit into this, but like I never wanted, I didn't want people to work on it for free because the movie was so much about how exploitive and shitty that show business can be. Like, I didn't want the behind the scenes of it to embody that in any way. So I did what they tell you never to do. And I took out a huge loan. I took out like I think, you know, like I'm about $100,000 in debt or something. I don't think not all of that went into the movie. A lot of that went into taking time off so that I could oversee this big, unwieldy, just sort of VFX nightmare that I sort of created for myself. But so yeah, I had this that kind of reserve of money to pull from to pay the artists as much as I could. And you know, again, it was like I didn't really have a roadmap. It was really like kind of going through and figuring out like what do we need for each of these moments, and how can we divide up the work, and what can I pay people? Because everybody that worked on it was underpaid. Like you said, like it's if I had $2 million to make it, like everybody would have gotten probably appropriately paid. But even then, it might have been a little. It might have been cutting it very close, just because like the amount of work that went into just even the green screen removal, like was took a year. Like it took a year just to get that like all in order.
But there's also such a thing as
But all.
barter, where these are all creative people. They're doing something for you, and you're presumably giving something back besides money.
Well, and that's the thing. That's the thing, you know, like 'cause like I'd worked for a lot of people and at a lot of places where like you'd get told like we're all family here, you know. And which is such an empty gesture. And like usually when somebody I always like to say if I get the chance to say that in interviews, I like to say it 'cause like I feel like a lot of like people who want to make film end up, you know, hearing these things 'cause they are interested in this movie and how it got made, and I'm like, if your boss is ever telling you that, run for the hills, because that just all that means is you're going to get underpaid, and you might even get told like what you just said, which is like you're going to get experience out of it or whatever, and like that so rarely happens. So often that just means you're like getting exploited. But like I wanted to apply this like different approach to it where it's like almost like you know, like a community garden or like a community art project or something where it's like there's a collectivist approach to it. Like, I always knew that my voice and my face, you know, my face is in like every shot of the movie. Like, I was never worried about my vision disappearing in it. So I would go to these artists and I'd be like, look, here's what I can afford to pay you. If you don't want to do it, like, please don't. Like, I want you to feel compensated. Both financially, but more than that, like just artistically. So like that meant like not really micromanaging what the artists were bringing to the table, you know, like it was like actually allowing the artists to like lean into their best aesthetics, like particularly, you know, like our we have like a broken down amusement park set that was just a 2D abstract painting of a broken down amusement park, which, you know, when I got that back, it was by this artist A.T. Pratt. Like when I got that back, it's like I don't know how I'm going to use this. This is a set we see so many times in the movie, and rather than like sending it back or like, you know, raising more money to like pay A.T. Pratt to do like another round of revisions or something, it was like, okay, like this is what they did and it's amazing. Let's figure out a way to make it work. So we like I got my 3D animators to, you know, cut out individual pieces of that, and we turned it into this like 3D diorama set. And
So cool.
and that was like kind of just the approach was just like sort of working with what people wanted to bring to the table and allowing them to really explore their best aesthetics. I mean, that's why I also like the Bat Cave in the movie looks like an old PlayStation game or like a like Doom 64. It's like Salem Hughes, the artist that made that and made the Batmobile, is just like she makes that kind of 3D model. So it was like that's perfect. Let's make all those sequences look like a Batman video game or something from like the 90s. So I think it like helps the movie feel so eclectic and queer. Sorry.
Don't be sorry. So is there a way, I've always wondered why can't someone just make a movie and like sort of give shares to the craftspeople or give shares to like the PAs or something, and then when the movie hits it big, if it, because most movies don't hit it big, but if this ends up making $10 million, can you then pay them out of that?
Yeah, you absolutely can. And I mean, like, there was a level of that, in place too, to a certain extent. Like my line producer on the movie, Joey Lyons, was making no money on this. And like, also, I think I don't even know if he necessarily knew exactly what a line producer does when until he was in it. Like, he was like, oh shit, like, what did I sign up for here? So it's like, that was a person where it's like, hey, like, you get points on the movie. Like,
Oh, yeah.
and when I was able to get like finishing funds via my distribution partners, like, let's go back and pay Joey more. Let's go back and like get like our character artists paid. Let's license these songs we want to use and stuff. And
That's cool.
particularly the actors too, like, because I didn't pay any of the actors except David Liebehart got paid above SAG rate, and that was just because like David is like a very hardworking actor who is constantly underpaid, and I was like, we're gonna pay David the most out of any of these actors.
Well,
But like all the other ones, it was like just favors. So it's like, yeah, they are definitely like cut in on shares for the movie. But I think with this one, it was like it was a little tricky just because like from the legal standpoint, I like didn't want to implicate anybody either, like financially.
yes. So
But
you
your
also.
point stands. I mean, like, that is what people should do. I think more like indie filmmakers could make really ambitious projects if they approached it from like a DIY community, sort of like co-op perspective.
Yeah, it's something I really want to try to do at some point. It's just, it seems like it's a lot of math and
Yes,
true.
yeah.
But the other, you did pay Robert Wool, I believe. You paid Robert Wool cameo fee.
I paid Robert Wool a cameo fee. At that point, what he pops up in the movie and he says, like, I can't be in this. So, and that was true. Like, I mean, like, I don't, But his message was just so sweet, like his he like he delivers this like sweet thing at the end where he's like, I'm so intrigued by what you're doing, and like I think you should do this, like you're breaking barriers, and like he's just basically like, you fucking go, girl, which was so cool to hear
Yeah.
because like he's just like this guy I saw in so many movies growing up, like kind of just this like weird like almost like movie dad or something, like just seeing like Alexander Knox, like encouraging me. So we ended up putting it in the movie. We screened it a few times at festivals. And then when it came time to like finally get the theatrical cut together, I was like, okay, I gotta go back to him now. Cause it needs to be in the movie. Like it needs
Does.
to be. It's like, so funny and just so sweet. And like, I don't know, like when we'd screen it at festivals, like people would just be cheering like at the end when he'd pop up back on screen. So I went back to him and I sent him another message on Cameo along with some money. And I was like, hey, I need to come clean here. I want to use this, and I'm willing to pay, a lot more money to do that. And he responded and he was just like, I'm so glad you finished this. Like, finishing any movie is hard, and I can't believe you finished this one. And yeah, I'd be glad to do it, and yeah, I'll definitely take your money. So it was cool. It was money well spent, just 'cause like it was such a cool get for us, and like just emotionally like meant so much to me that he was so encouraging.
I was gonna say he's the least of your legal troubles. It sounds like you there was the whole situation at TIFF, which I'm gonna briefly summarize because I'm sure you're so sick of talking about it. But you have a
Yeah.
showing at TIFF, some people with great taste stuck their necks out to get it at TIFF. Had a great reception. It was like the most memorable thing out of TIFF this past year was sort of the drama around it. Then suddenly it was sort of disappeared after a letter, not a cease and desist, but a letter was sent from WB expressing some concerns, I guess. Did you know all this was going to happen ahead of time through your lawyers? Because you also had a lot of lawyers, right?
I did, but I was kind of blindsided. I just always thought Warner Brothers was going to ignore the movie just because of like how scrappy the production of it was, and just how like I mean, when people see the movie, it's like it's so clearly not a movie that they would make. It's not a movie that's trying to disguise itself as a movie they'd make. So like I've never thought of it as a thing that infringes on their brand, and my lawyers never did. But I think because it got into TIFF, that put a lot more of a spotlight on it. We had pretty big distribution interests ahead of that premiere,
Yeah.
and like kind of already had some deals going into place, and I think they just kind of wanted to kill those deals, which really hurt. Just because, like, I don't know, like I had never been to a film festival before TIFF, so I didn't like either as a filmmaker or as a fan, so like I didn't really know how big and huge TIFF was, so like I kind of just thought like we were doing it sort of in a vacuum, in the same way that we had like made the movie kind of in this vacuum. But yeah, I guess I was kind of naive, and then like what happened, and thank you for summarizing it so I don't have to. Oh, sorry, I'm burping so much. Jesus.
You also
Whatever.
clean up quite a bit in a legal sense in the credits, even where you stipulate what's fair use. And also that you're very clear this movie is a parody and there is some parody protection under Supreme Court decisions. People could fight it out in court if they want to, but you can't watch this movie and not think it's a parody. It's definitely
Oh,
a
yeah.
parody.
Definitely. And thank you for saying that too, just because like I think that was one of the weird things that happened after TIFF, was just the sort of banned filmmaker thing, the sort of like shelved film, like people talk about it like it was so cool, and for me it was devastating because I was just like, why? Like this movie can come out, like it's perfectly legal. It's like but like I don't know, like I think thankfully, like you said, like TIFF really advocated for us, and then we did a whole little fe film festival run last year that like a lot of them were secret screenings, but the secret screenings were like I would spread rumors and say like People's Joker screening here, and like we'd also like we'd always like title it in their like film festival programs as something along the lines of like an untitled queer clown coming of age parody. And then like the description of it would be like an unfunny trans clown moves to a city and is hunted by a cape crusader. So like if you knew what the movie was, you would show up and go. So like that saved my life. Like film festivals and like the film and genre community and like the micro budget community like just fucking rallied around me, 'cause I was just like a mess last year, like emotionally and anxiety wise, because like I just did not know, because I mean I was in a ton of debt from this film and just had no idea what was gonna come of it. And thankfully like it was the queer cinema community really accepted me, but it was really honestly the genre film community that fucking really showed up for me, like people like Joe Lynch. He just made that movie Suitable Flesh, which is fucking phenomenal. Everybody can see it on Shudder. Especially if you like grew up loving Barbara Crampton and or Heather Graham. They're both in that and they kiss in it. See it. Like he was somebody who like was very supportive, and the Fantastic Fest community was very supportive, and just in Australia, like Australia genre film, like fucking love this movie in Australia. I'm kind of blown away by it. I think part of it is because we have a lot of Ben Folds jokes in the movie, and Ben Folds is just like a mainstream musician in Australia.
There are a lot of
It
Ben.
was just
There's so many jokes I feel like I could ask you about, but We don't have time. Like, I
No, that's fine.
let's talk
Yeah.
again someday because there's a lot of jokes from like,
A
that's
lot
a
of
great
jokes.
joke. I don't think anyone's gonna get, and I really like it.
Thank you.
You
But no, I mean, I think it just speaks to like when you make something like this, you really, I don't know, just don't give up hope and like just find that circle of filmmakers who want to help you get your thing out there because they're out there. Like, it's a bleak time to be making film, like at least in Hollywood. Like, everybody's just so depressed when you go on any meeting now because of like AI and shit. But like, indie film is more alive than it has ever been. And like, filmmaking to me is the most democratized it's ever been. Like, and we all can and kind of are really taking care of each other. And that was really the only reason my movie ever was able to come out of limbo. That and just the audiences that supported us during the festival run. So it really means a lot. And because this movie was made to sort of heal a lot of my relationship, not only to my gender, but just to comedy and like making art. And it has done that. It has done that like to like a degree that I cannot imagine. Like, I would have never imagined. I would have always hoped for, but I could have never imagined the response being like this and being able to have conversations like this too. It's just it's still so trippy and lovely.